I know it's some big shoes to fill following up after Nathan and Brother Randy, but I appreciate the opportunity very much. I hope that as we kind of draw the meeting to a close, I hope I can bring some words that are encouraging. I hope we can bring some encouragement that we can all take back home with us as we all return to our home congregations. But to just kind of sort of set the backstory for what we're going to be studying this afternoon, I'll share this little bit of a backstory. A few years ago, I spent a decent amount of time studying through the book of Jonah. We did a short series of sermons back at home going through the book of Jonah. And as I went through that exercise, I was kind of disappointed in myself. And I was shocked at how little I actually understood about a book that I thought was seemingly simple, that I thought that I knew and that I understood so very well. I mean, after all, the book of Jonah, that's the story of Jonah and the whale. That's one that we've been hearing since we were little kids. But still yet, I have failed to see some of the greater teachings and some of the application that comes from that story. In fact, I remember coming across a quote that read this. It says, "And this is the tragedy of the book of Jonah, that a book which is made the means of one of the most sublime revelations of truth in the Old Testament should be known to most only for its connections with a whale." You know, that's where I was. That's kind of where I was at the point. And I think there's a lot of truth to that. While Old Testament stories, they can be entertaining, they can be fun, we can find application within Old Testament stories to our lives today, we can never forget about what they're teaching us about God and about His nature and about His Son and how they lead us to His Son. And keeping that frame of mind will also help us when we begin to encounter and deal with difficult passages that might not necessarily have any application to our lives today. But at the conclusion of that study, as we went through the book of Jonah, we at the conclusion spent a great deal of time talking about Luke chapter 11, where Jesus himself goes back and he makes reference to this story of Jonah and the Ninevites. There in Luke chapter 11 and verse 29, we find, "And while the crowds were thickly gathered together, he began to say, 'This is an evil generation. It seeks a sign, and no sign will be given to it except the sign of Jonah the prophet. For as Jonah became a sign to the Ninevites, so also the Son of Man will be to this generation.'" And then you jump down to verse 32, where Jesus continues, and he says, "The men of Nineveh will rise up in the judgment with this generation and condemn it. For they repented at the preaching of Jonah, and indeed a greater than Jonah is here." A greater than Jonah is here. This method of teaching by moving from the lesser to the now greater, that's a very common practice for biblical writers. For example, when we begin talking about the Lord's Supper and looking at an explanation of the Lord's Supper, our viewpoint as we look from the Passover to the Lord's Supper should be that of moving from the lesser to the greater. And that's a very common teaching method that New Testament writers employ to be able to better explain and to be able to solidify their points. I'll give you another example. The Hebrew writer uses this very same technique in Hebrews chapter 12, verses 25 and 27. Brother Randy made mention of this passage in his sermon yesterday evening. Hebrews chapter 12, beginning in verse 25, says, "See that you do not refuse him who speaks. For if they did not escape him who refused him who spoke on earth, much more shall we not escape if we turn away from him who speaks from heaven, whose voice then shook the earth, but now he has promised, saying, 'Yet once more I shake not only the earth, but also heaven.' Now this 'yet once more' indicates the removal of those things that are being shaken, as of things that are made, that the things which cannot be shaken may remain." Brother Andy pointed out that man who spoke on earth, that was Moses. And when God met with the children of Israel at Mount Sinai, this was a very shocking, it was a very awe-inspiring experience. You can imagine yourself being there, and as the earth begins to shake, and the mountain begins to be filled with smoke, and the trumpet begins to blare louder and louder and louder, everybody on that day understood the awesomeness and the frightful power of God's word that was being delivered. Everybody understood and they appreciated that. And the Hebrew writer, he says, that was the lesser. That was the lesser. And if you couldn't escape him who spoke on the earth, how could we possibly escape him who speaks from heaven? The point is, when the word was made flesh through Jesus Christ, there remained no more excuse for disobedience or a lack of knowledge of God's will. As great and as awesome as the events on Mount Sinai were, when Jesus came to the earth and he began speaking as God, it was even greater. And in this case here in Luke chapter 11, Jesus is using this very same lesser to greater strategy. The point is, the people of Nazareth, they saw the sign of Jonah returning from the depths of Sheol, as it's called. He spent 3 days in the belly of the fish. And when they saw him come up on that beach, they saw that sign, they repented. They repented with great sorrow and with anguish. They repented. They changed their lives. They turned their lives around and they turned to service to God. So he forces you to ask the question, what would those men think of us? What would they think of us? We stand here today with undeniable evidence that God's own Son, he came to the earth, he dwelt with man, he gave his life on the cross, and he was resurrected to become the first fruits of the bodily resurrection. What greater sign do you want? What greater sign do you need to obey and to repent? What would they think if we fail to obey him in nothing less than sackcloth and ashes as they did? What would they do? What would be their response and their answer to us? Well, they would rise up in judgment and they would condemn us just as they should. So there's kind of my introduction, my little bit of a backstory. So now I want to return back to Luke chapter 11, and I want to look there at verse 31. Luke chapter 11 and verse 31. There he again says, "The queen of the south will rise up in the judgment with the men of this generation and condemn them. For she came from the ends of the earth to hear the wisdom of Solomon." And once again he says, "And indeed, a greater than Solomon is here." In his reference there back to Jonah, and just what was a very few short words, Jesus is making some very profound and some very bold statements about who he is and about what he's there to accomplish. And in doing so, as he makes these short references to the story of Jonah, he's assuming that you understand the entire backstory. He's assuming that you, as the reader, you understand the story of Jonah and the Ninevites and what he's referencing. And now here he's doing the very same thing as he references this woman, this queen of the south. So this afternoon, for just a few minutes, we're going to go back and we're going to look at the story that Jesus is referencing of this woman, this queen of the south, and we're going to look at some of the context that surrounds that story so that by the end of the study, hopefully we'll have a better and a fuller appreciation of the words that Jesus spoke on that occasion, and hopefully a better appreciation for the kingdom. There's a lot of weight behind that phrase, "Indeed, a greater than Solomon is here." That's an important phrase, and I hope you'll appreciate that by the end of the study. But when you look at the life of Solomon, up until the point of his failure, a great deal of Solomon's kingdom is a great picture of what God's kingdom is to look like. In the third chapter of 1 Kings, God comes to Solomon, and he tells him, "Solomon, you ask of me whatever it is that you need to lead my people, and I will give it to you. Whatever it is that you need, you ask it of me, and so it shall be given to you." So Solomon responds in 1 Kings chapter 3. This is where we're going to be spending the bulk of the remainder of our sermon here, if you'd like to turn to 1 Kings. But he responds in 1 Kings chapter 3, verses 7 through 12, and he says this, "Now, O Lord my God, you have made your servant king instead of my father David. But I am a little child. I do not know how to go out or to come in. And your servant is in the midst of your people whom you have chosen, a great people, too numerous to be counted or numbered. Therefore, give to your servant an understanding heart to judge your people that I may discern between good and evil. For who is able to judge this great people of yours?" Samuel responds here very wisely for a young man. He responds with an appropriate response for any leader of God's people. He understood that this is a very grave responsibility that it was to care for God's people. And it was of his utmost concern here that he begins to lead his people in a way that is pleasing and honorable to God. So as he makes this request, he doesn't make a request like the kings of the nations would. He doesn't ask for gold or for silver or for many wives or for wealth. But instead he asks for wisdom. For wisdom. And the Lord is so pleased with Solomon's request that he not only grants him with the greatest wisdom of any man to ever live, but he also granted Solomon incredible wealth and power that came from that wisdom. In verse 10, continuing on there, in 1 Kings chapter 3, verse 10, it says, "The speech pleased the Lord that Solomon had asked this thing. Then God said to him, 'Because you have asked this thing and have not asked long life for yourself, nor have asked for riches for yourself, nor have asked the life of your enemies, but have asked for yourself understanding to discern justice, behold, I have done according to your words. See, I have given you a wise and understanding heart, so that there has not been anyone like you before you, nor shall any like you arise after you.'" God is very pleased, and so he grants him above and beyond the things that Solomon asks. And as you begin to get into chapter 4, you realize that many of these things are occurring. God's blessings are beginning to get poured out to Solomon. As you get to chapter 4, there's almost an exhaustive list and an exhaustive description that begins to take place of the leadership of Solomon's kingdom. The first 19 verses there of the chapter, it goes into great detail. It gives the exact names of his leaders and of his governors, and it describes all of their responsibilities and their rule. And there's great detail that goes into describing the kingdom and the great wealth of the kingdom and all the beauty and the grandeur of his kingdom. And as you read through all this and this exhaustive description, you have to ask yourself, what's the point? What's the point of all of this exhaustive detail? What's the purpose of describing all of these men that are serving under Solomon and all of the things that they're in charge of, and giving such precise detail onto the structure and the organization of his kingdom? One commentator, he writes this, he says, "The purpose of including all these details about Solomon's wisdom, largesse, polity, and administration is not transparent." So the commentator basically says, he gets this section, he says, I don't really know what to do with all of this detail. But the truth is, this chapter is actually pretty incredible. Because what on the surface appears to just be mindless details are actually, I believe, meant to be clues to something that's much greater that's coming with Jesus. In the first 20 verses of chapter 4, what you very quickly start to realize is that God truly is blessing this kingdom. He's blessing Solomon and his kingdom. And as you begin to scan your eyes through those first 20 verses, and you see all these men's names, and all that they're in charge of, and the structure and the leadership of this kingdom, what becomes very, very apparent is that God has certainly kept his promises to Solomon. He has fulfilled his promises. What you're seeing is God confirming that this kingdom set up through Solomon has been completely established. There is no external threat. There are no worries. You know, this was something that, as great as King David was, as great as he was, because of the fact that he was always in disputes and there was always threats of external war in the borders, he's always on the run. He's always running from King Saul, or he's running from his enemies. And he's never able to set up an administration or the security as Solomon is able to do here in the book of 1 Kings. As Nathan mentioned this morning, there are always some sort of problem that's arising here while David is on the throne. But now with Solomon, you see here there's no external threats. There's no fear that Solomon's going to have to get up from the throne and take off on the run, or that nations are going to rise up against him, because the kingdom here is thoroughly established. Solomon even makes reference to this in chapter 5 and verse 3. He says, "You know how my father David could not build a house for the name of the Lord his God because of the wars which were fought against him on every side, until the Lord put his foes under the soles of his feet. But now the Lord my God has given me rest on every side. There is neither adversary nor evil occurrence." And so there's a great deal of rest and security that's come with God's promises to Solomon. But now look here at chapter 4 and verse 20. "Judah and Israel were as numerous as the sand by the sea in multitude, eating and drinking and rejoicing." That phrase there, that they're as numerous as the sand by the sea, that should kind of trigger a little spark in your memory. That should kind of remind you back to the promises that God made to Abraham back in Genesis chapter 22. In Genesis chapter 22 and verse 16, God said, "By myself I have sworn, says the Lord, because you have done this thing and have not withheld your son, your only son, blessing I will bless you, and multiplying I will multiply your descendants as the stars of the heaven and as the sand which is on the seashore. And your descendants shall possess the gate of their enemies. In your seed all the nations of the earth shall be blessed because you have obeyed my voice." So the promises that God had made to Abraham, they're continuing to be fulfilled here with Solomon. The land, it's established. The people are multiplying as the sand of the seashore. Their gates are secure. God's promises are being fulfilled. The fact that people are eating and they're drinking and rejoicing shows that the people are happy. They're cheerful. They're secure. They're rested. There's no threat from the surrounding nations, and the kingdom is functioning as it should. And as verse 20 mentions, this has an effect on the people. They're able to rest, they're eating, they're drinking, they're happy. It gives a picture that the people's needs are being met in great abundance. Everything is running smoothly, and the people are comforted. This is the first of three pictures here of this kingdom. And this picture here portrays to us that this is in fact a blessed kingdom. God is blessing this kingdom and its people. God is with Solomon. The kingdom is established and the blessings are literally pouring out to the people. But the second picture of the kingdom is that it is wealthy beyond compare. It is a very, very wealthy kingdom. To help you get a grasp on just the sheer wealth that Israel possesses at this time, I want to read here chapter 4, verses 21 through 28. Being in there in verse 21, "So Solomon reigned over all kingdoms from the river to the land of the Philistines as far as the border of Egypt. They brought tribute and served Solomon all the days of his life. Now Solomon's provision for one day was 30 cores of fine flour, 60 cores of meal, 10 fatted oxen, 20 oxen from the pastures, and 100 sheep, besides deer, gazelles, roebucks, and fatted fowl. For he had dominion over all the region on this side of the river from Tifsha even to Gaza, namely over all the kings on this side of the river, and he had peace on every side all around him. And Judah and Israel dwelt safely, each man under his vine and his fig tree, from Dan as far as Beersheba, all the days of Solomon. Solomon had 40,000 stalls of horses for his chariots, and 12,000 horsemen. And these governors, each man in his month, provided food for King Solomon and for all who came to King Solomon's table. There was no lack in their supply. They also brought barley and straw to the proper place for the horses and steeds, each man according to his charge." When you think back to the book of Samuel, what a stark contrast this is to where the nation of Israel was back at the book, in the time of Samuel. In Samuel, you know, for decades and decades, the Philistines, they're just bearing down. The surrounding nations are bearing down on Israel, constantly threatening war. And now under Solomon, the nations are bringing him tribute. The nations are bringing him tribute. Verse 22 tells us that every single day, food is literally flowing into Solomon from the surrounding countries. Verse 25 says, "And Judah and Israel dwelt safely, each man under his vine and his fig tree, from Dan as far as Beersheba, all the days of Solomon." That's a little bit of an odd phrase, that each man is dwelling under his own vine and his fig tree. But that's actually a phrase that some of the later prophets would use as they prophesy of the Messiah. It's a picture of peace and rest and abundance. Everyone has the abundance that they need. They're provided for, they're satisfied, and there is no threat. Verse 27, there's actually a good summation of it where the writer says, there was no lack in their supply. There's no lack anywhere you look. They have what they need, they're satisfied, and all is well. Now flip ahead to chapter 10. I want to look there at verses 14 through 23. A little bit of a lengthy reading here, but I think it kind of vividly describes just the jaw-dropping wealth that Israel possesses. 1 Kings chapter 10, beginning in verse 14. The weight of gold that came to Solomon yearly was 666 talents of gold. Besides that, from the traveling merchants, from the income of traders, from all the kings of Arabia, and from the governors of the country. And King Solomon made 200 large shields of hammered gold, 600 shekels of gold went into each shield. He also made 300 shields of hammered gold, 3 minas of gold went into each shield. The king put them in the house of the forest of Lebanon. Moreover, the king made a great throne of ivory and overlaid it with pure gold. The throne had 6 steps. At the top of the throne was round at the back. There were armrests on either side of the place of the seat, and 2 lions stood beside the armrests. 12 lions stood there, one on each side of the 6 steps. Nothing like this had been made for any other kingdom. All King Solomon's drinking vessels were gold, and all the vessels of the house of the forest of Lebanon were pure gold. Not one was silver, for this was accounted as nothing in the days of Solomon. For the king had merchant ships at sea with the fleet of Hiram. Once every 3 years the merchant ships came bringing gold, silver, ivory, apes, and monkeys. So King Solomon surpassed all the kings of the earth in riches and wisdom. You know, you read that and it's hard to grasp just how wealthy this kingdom is and what this would have looked like to witness this. Imagine being in a time when gold is so abundant, there's so much gold, that silver just counts as nothing. It's worthless because there's so much gold within the kingdom. For the sake of time, we couldn't talk about the temple and the beauty and the grandeur of the temple and all the beauty that it possessed. And as men would walk into this kingdom, as they would walk down the streets of Solomon's kingdom, they would be struck by the tremendous beauty and the gold and the silver that it possessed. What an unbelievable picture of this kingdom. So it's a blessed kingdom. It's an extremely, extremely wealthy kingdom. And now this third picture goes on to show what a wise kingdom is. Look at chapter 4, verse 29. Chapter 4 and verse 29. And God gave Solomon wisdom and exceedingly great understanding and largeness of heart like the sand on the seashore. Thus Solomon's wisdom excelled the wisdom of all the men of the east and all the wisdom of Egypt, for he was wiser than all men. In the next few verses there, they go on to describe all of Solomon's accomplishments in literature and in songs and so on, all of which we still admire, we benefit from today. But once again here, his wisdom is described as being like the sand of the seashore and the largeness of his heart. That's a strange way to describe some of these characteristics, but it's bringing us back once again to the memories of God's promises to Abraham. Solomon, with all of his wisdom, is wise for the good of the people and for the purpose of showing God's greatness to the world. And I believe those little references back to Abraham, those are continual reminders through the description of Solomon's reign to constantly remind us that ultimately, God is still king. God is still the one who is reigning. Though his blessings are flowing through Solomon, it's still God that is the source, and it's his plan that's being fulfilled. And ultimately, what you're seeing through the whole of this chapter is that everybody, and I mean everybody through the world over, wants to be a member of this kingdom. Everybody wants to see it. Everyone wants to come benefit from it. Everyone wants to experience the wisdom that's coming from Solomon. we still read, we study about his wisdom. We benefit from the wisdom of Solomon. It guides us on how to avoid the pitfalls of life, how to focus on things eternal, how to serve God through all seasons of life. Verse 34 there says, "And men of all nations, from all the kings of the earth who had heard of his wisdom, came to hear the wisdom of Solomon." Everybody at this point has heard about this man Solomon. And people from all over the land, they're coming to hear the wisdom from this man's mouth, to witness and experience this kingdom. Everybody wants to belong to a kingdom like this and enjoy the blessings that the nation is receiving. Nobody wants to be left out from God's blessings that are being extended through Solomon. And that ultimately brings us to the Queen of the South. Look at chapter 10, and we'll read verses 1 through 9. 1 Kings chapter 10, verses 1 through 9. "Now when the Queen of Sheba heard of the fame of Solomon concerning the name of the Lord, she came to test him with hard questions. She came to Jerusalem with a very great retinue, with camels that bore spices, very much gold, and precious stones. And when she came to Solomon, she spoke with him about all that was in her heart. So Solomon answered all her questions. There was nothing so difficult for the king that he could not explain it to her. And when the Queen of Sheba had seen all the wisdom of Solomon, the house that he had built, the food on his table, the seating of his servants, the service of his waiters and their apparel, his cupbearers, and his entryway by which he went up to the house of the Lord, there was no more spirit in her. Then she said to the king, 'It was a true report which I heard in my own land about your words and your wisdom. However, I did not believe the words until I came and saw with my own eyes. And indeed, the half was not told to me. Your wisdom and prosperity exceeds the fame of which I heard. Happy are your men, and happy are these your servants, who stand continually before you and hear your wisdom. Blessed be the Lord your God, who delighted in you, setting you on the throne of Israel. Because the Lord has loved Israel forever, therefore he made you king, to do justice and righteousness.'" You think about the journey that this woman made, the journey that the Queen of Sheba had taken to get here would have at least taken a couple of years of very hard and very strenuous travel. No doubt made even more difficult by all of the gifts and the grandeur that she's bringing along on this journey to provide to Solomon. But this woman, she had heard stories and heard men talk about the unbelievable blessings that this kingdom is receiving. She had heard stories about the unbelievable wisdom of this man Solomon that has come from the Lord. But to believe it, she has to see it with her own eyes. And when she arrives at the kingdom and she sees the glory and the wonder of this kingdom, she speaks to Solomon, she hears his wisdom, she realizes that she hasn't even heard the half of it. Hadn't even heard the half of it. Imagine belonging to a kingdom like that. Full of peace, full of riches, full of joy, full of rest. Imagine being a part of something that everybody wants to be a part of. Imagine having a ruler like this, where all the riches are being distributed. Everybody's cared for. There aren't threats from enemies. And the king is legitimately wanting the best for his people. I think everybody would agree here, they would love to be a member of a kingdom such as this. But now hold all of that in your mind, everything that we've talked about, the glory of this kingdom, and consider the statement that Jesus makes here. As you now hopefully have a firm grasp on this wisdom, on the prosperity, and on the peace that existed under the reign of Solomon, listen again to what Jesus says in Luke chapter 11 and verse 31. Luke chapter 11 and verse 31. "The queen of the south will rise up in the judgment with the men of this generation and condemn it, For she came from the ends of the earth to hear the wisdom of Solomon, and indeed a greater than Solomon is here. To appreciate Jesus' words, you have to have an appreciation of what Solomon's kingdom looked like. How truly blessed it was in wealth, in wisdom, in security. And then as Jesus enters the scene, he tells us that something greater is here right now, at this very moment. How could there be something greater than Solomon's kingdom? For Jesus to come along and say that his kingdom is greater than Solomon's, that should put into perspective how grand and how powerful the reign of Christ truly is. As good as it sounded to live under the reign of Solomon, to enjoy all these physical blessings, and have all this great wealth and this security, to belong to Jesus and to be a member of his kingdom is exponentially greater. Think about it. Christ, the Word in the flesh, he is the wisdom of God. He isn't just receiving the wisdom, but he is the wisdom. In regards to his wealth, he owns everything. He made it all. He owns all of it. We can barely grasp the grandeur of Solomon's kingdom, and yet Christ is infinitely greater than his. In Solomon's day, people like the Queen of the South, the Queen of Sheba, they're willing to risk their lives, to give everything. They're willing to travel unbelievable distances just to experience it, just to see it with their own eyes, to see and witness this reign of Solomon, to risk it all, to be able to see the blessings that God is fulfilling through him. And now here's Jesus, an exponentially greater king, with exponentially greater blessings to offer and to extend, and he's coming down to them. They don't have to go 5 feet to see his kingdom. People traveled across the world to see Solomon, and yet Jesus is the contrast of that. He comes down to us, and he reveals his great kingdom. But what do the people do? What's the response? Well, they reject him. Nobody's willing to enjoy the blessings that Christ has to offer. They mock his kingship, and they turn away from his blessings. If men would travel the earth to see Solomon, how much more should they be exhausting every effort to make it to the Son of God? And yet we don't have to travel the earth because it's right here in front of us. The Queen of the South, she would have given anything to be able to experience the blessings of Christ that we have today. And when we refuse to submit to Christ, to obey his commandments, she would rise up and she would condemn us. She would scorn us for refusing to see the glory of Christ's reign and the unmatched wealth and security that comes with belonging to his kingdom, being a member of his kingdom. You know, it's all too easy to lose sight of the value that Christ offers because we can't always see it from our earthly perspective. Imagine if Solomon came to the people of the world, all the people of the earth today, and he said, I'll offer you all of the blessings of my kingdom. I'll extend it all out to you. You'll be secured. You'll be provided for. You'll be able to take part and experience my wisdom that I'll extend to you. You'll have your own vine and your own fig tree, as the prophets say. But to enjoy those blessings, you have to submit to my reign. You have to obey my commandments. People of the world, they would agree to that, no questions asked. I'm in. I'm in. I want to experience these blessings. Well, how much more should we want to belong to the kingdom of Christ? Amen. To have a ruler that rules in righteousness, who uses his power and riches for the good of his people, who isn't just the wisest man to walk the earth, but he is wisdom. That is the king that we have. Never forget the unbelievable blessing that it is to be a Christian. Solomon, much like his father, he would ultimately throw away everything that he had. With all that wisdom, he still failed to obey it. He threw it all away. As wise as he was, as much as he loved and cared for his people, he throws it away. You know, the surrounding nations, they would once again take over. All the wealth that they had enjoyed would be pillaged, it would be plundered and torn away. But not so with Christ. At the conclusion of the discussion in Hebrews that we mentioned in our introduction, as he's wrapping up his point about Christ speaking from heaven, the Hebrew writer says in chapter 12 and verse 28, he says this, "Therefore, since we are receiving a kingdom which cannot be shaken, let us have grace by which we may serve God acceptably with reverence and godly fear." Christ's kingdom will not be shaken. It will not be shaken. The unmatched blessings of Christ are offered to everyone. His wealth, his security, his wisdom, and his kingdom, which will be never shaken by the test of time. But it requires your obedience, your submission to the great King. This afternoon, if you're here and you've never obeyed the call of Christ, don't find yourself being one that the Queen of the South would rise up and condemn, who she would scorn. If you've never been baptized into his kingdom, and you've never submitted to his reign, then don't expect to receive his blessings. If you're here and you've never obeyed the gospel, then you need to do that today. You need to take advantage of that invitation right here and right now. Why not come to Christ, hearing his word, believing it to be truth, repenting of your past sins, confessing that he truly is the Son of God, and be baptized to become a member of his church, of his kingdom. Likewise, if you're here and you have become a Christian, but maybe you've strayed away and you haven't lived the life that you should, then we'd love to assist you. We'd love to help you with that. Brethren, we'd love to pray with you and for you. If there's one here of either class, we encourage you to come forward as we stand and as we sing.